Welcome. We are so honored to have all of you in this room. And my name is Elizabeth Gore. I am the Entrepreneur in Residence at the United Nations Foundation. And we are being recorded on the radio today. And so a couple of requests. One is to silence your cell phones. And the second one is, as you have questions, you have blue cards in your seat. If you could fill those out, and then someone will be walking up and down the aisle to receive those cards. And I will be asking them of our panelists as we go throughout the day. So today we have three distinguished guests to talk to us about a transforming continent, innovation and entrepreneurship in Africa. So let me please introduce my guests. First, we have Jake Bright. He's a Whitehead Fellow at the Foreign Policy Association. Eric Hirschman, who is the Director of Operations and Strategy at USAID. And Miriam Jam, who is the President and CEO of Spot One Global Solutions. And I think between the three of them, we will have a master's degree in innovation by the time we all walk out of here today. Let me just open with what we were really thinking as we were putting this content together. Many of us have talked, and we were just discussing it even before this, that the continent of Africa is still viewed sometimes through a negative lens of drought, of corruption, of violence. And although a lot of difficult obstacles remain, we really see it as a transformational moment for these 55 countries that are overcoming great things to be emerging economies, to be leaders in innovation and technology, to have women at the forefront, and most of all, to solve their own problems in partnership with not only everyone in this room, but most of all, with their peers sitting to their right and their left. There is a $1 trillion investment opportunity in the continent just on energy access alone. Mobile phones have now penetrated the market there. I was in Uganda last week, and there's a 90% uptake in mobile phones alone. So that can just show you that individuals might be in a refugee camp or in a slum, but they do have a mobile phone and access to information and technology. We have seen the African diaspora stepping up and investing in their own. There are venture capital funds that are popping up all over. And 2 weeks ago, one of the richest young men in Africa, Ashish Thakkar of Uganda, stepped forward and said on his own that he will only be investing in his own continent. So all of this said, my role as Entrepreneur Resident supporting the United Nations, I look at what are the best innovations that we can scale with the private sector that save lives. So for us, the lines are merging between social and for-profit entrepreneurism, and what we might think of a great investment might also be providing jobs, giving people maternal health access, preventing disease outbreaks. So we see this as great opportunity. But I think the difficulty in all of us is how do we redefine the word entrepreneur? So that said, I really look forward to opening it up and asking our guests to kind of give an overview of their thoughts of innovation and entrepreneurship in Africa. And Jake, I'm going to ask you to start, please.
Yes, thank you. Thanks, Elizabeth. Thanks, World Affairs Council. I'm so happy that I was invited out here to speak with this great panel. And I guess I have a minute opening, so I'll try to explain just quickly who I am and what I've been doing with Africa. I'm a Wall Street dropout who made an even better decision to go transition to media. And for the last several years, I've been documenting, writing on, speaking on primarily business, but also this topic of what's going on in Africa. Why are all the leading strategy consulting firms writing reports on it? What's happening in African business? Why is everybody talking about it, and what does it mean for Africa and for the United States? So I've jumped into that, and I've tried to find a simple way to explain it very concisely, and I'll try to do that right now. In broad brushstrokes, I would characterize what's happening in sub-Saharan Africa as the continent is going largely from being on the sidelines of a global economy. And everything you think you know about Africa in terms of the negative stereotypes and, being largely dependent on foreign aid, that's changing rapidly. And it's largely a narrative driven by business. And there are several things within that narrative that are fleshing out. And what it means is that Africa, in terms of its influence, its power, the things that are coming from Africa are going to change rapidly, and everything you know about Africa is going to change. There are several things to look at, and I'll go very quickly. So if I want to break down what's happening in African business with just several, you know, several topics, the first thing is you look at several areas: its growth, its investment, its modernization, its demographics, and I also throw in the diaspora. Quickly through each of those, and then I'll conclude. On growth, some people are tired of hearing about this. Some people may be hearing about it for the first time. Africa's had and has projected the fastest growing economies in the world. And the other part of that story is that it's not just commodities, which a lot of people dismissed that originally, saying it's just a commodities boom. A lot of this growth is diversified. When you get into investment, the scale of foreign direct investment going into Africa right now is just absolutely massive. You're looking at numbers. I mean, you're throwing around billion-dollar chunks of money that's being invested in Africa in all kinds of different ways, in all kinds of different countries, and the scale is just massive. When you get into modernization, the entire infrastructure grid of the continent is being reviewed, and there's a mass mobilization of resources to upgrade Africa's infrastructure and also upgrade, you know, things from roads to bridges to Africa's capital markets, banking, technology, infrastructure, changing rapidly. When you get into demographics, Africa's becoming one of the world's new consumer markets. It's estimated that the consumers in Africa will spend, I think it's $1 trillion by 2020. And then when you get into the diaspora, and this is the final point, and I'll concede, the diaspora is really fleshing itself out and proving to be a tremendous force in terms of its affluence abroad, and also the connections that are starting to happen between the diaspora and these immigrant communities in the United States and Europe, who have now, in the U.S., African immigrants are now the highest educated demographic in the entire country. In certain cases, when you get into Nigerians, they have some of the highest per capita income of anybody in the country. And you have this capacity coming back to Africa in many forms through entrepreneurs. And the other thing that's interesting is the diaspora is starting to send record amounts of money back home through remittances, to the point where diaspora funds are now exceeding foreign aid for the entire continent. So all these things are happening. Where it's going to go is the fun part, and what I'm trying to write about and what we'll speak about. But those are some of the broad brushstrokes that I would paint as to what's going on in Africa, how it's influencing the continent, and also how it's leading to a lot of innovation that hopefully we'll hear about more on the panel.
Great. Miriam, I'd love to hear your opening thoughts.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very honored and privileged to be here. How many people have been to Africa in this room? Wow, okay. That's fantastic. So you can see what I'm going to say. It's not going to be nonsense. What I really wanted to, the reason why I wanted to come here today is that I want to share with you what's happening in Africa based on fact and evidence. I live in London in the United Kingdom, and when you are in London, you are bombarded with the negative narrative about Africa. So from the BBC, you see all the negative stuff. But I've been going to Africa as part of the diaspora for nearly 10 years now. I've been going back and forth with my business and helping women across Africa. And what I see right now is we have progress in the continent. You know, you've been to Africa. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that everything is rose, everything is fantastic, everything is beautiful. People have internet connections and things are working very well. But what I wanted to see is that, what I want to tell you is that Africa, the rise, you know, the African narrative you see, the Africa rising, that's not fact. But Africa is progressing, that's fact. So we are really progressing in the continent, from all over the continent, just the 54 countries, we are progressing massively. And I'm just going to talk about women in tech, how women are improving from rural villages to the markets in Africa to boardrooms in Africa. They are really progressing. We have women CIOs, we have women in ICT, not women just in ICT, but we have women who are coding from Nairobi to Madagascar. Those kind of things we don't talk about in the United States, because the African woman in the United States is seen as an object of development. That's sadly the media. That's how we portray African women. But if you go to Africa today, you go to my country, Senegal, you got women sitting in boardrooms, you got women coding from Java to PHP. So I want to share that what women are doing across the continent with you, and how we investing into mentorship. So if you're thinking, how am I going to invest in Africa? You know, I don't know where to go, where to invest, who to speak to in Africa. You know, you can mentor women in Africa. There are some massive mentorship programs happening in the continent from Uganda to Senegal. So you can mentor women. You can invest in women, invest in programs, project that works very, very well across the continent. So I just want to, because I know that Eric will be tapping some on investment and innovation, but Africa is an innovative continent right now. We are tapping into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics in the continent. Yesterday, we were working with Paul Kagame and the World Bank Vice President just to show you that how people are taking seriously the continent. So if you think of where to invest, think about women, one. The second, think about the STEM subjects where you can also put your money in. But we can talk about that later.
Thank you, Mariam. Eric, your opening thoughts.
Yeah, so thanks for having me here. It's good to be back in San Francisco. Though I don't look or sound like it, I did grow up in Sudan and Kenya, and I live in Nairobi. And I'm one of the co-founders of Ushahidi, a software platform that's made for crowdsourcing information generally used during crisis, disasters, elections. It's been deployed in 159 countries, 50,000 deployments from everything from the Haiti earthquake to Japan's tsunami. I'm also the founder of the iHub, the innovation hub in Nairobi, which has started off as just a community effort to get the people in that community together. So it's now 11,000 members, four floors in a building, and it's grown considerably. There's a lot of startups that come out of it, which led to one of the other things that I do, which is I'm a partner in the Savannah Fund, which is a seed stage accelerator fund for these startups. And we don't just fund ones in Kenya, but they can come from all over Africa. So we've funded 11 startups thus far. In the last year and a half, and we're about to do our next batch of five. So it's really interesting to be on the ground doing stuff. So what I find interesting is the narrative that Mariam and Jake were talking about is this kind of the problem that the narrative of Africa, the perception of it, hasn't changed since the 80s and 90s. But the fact is that the 80s and 90s is not the Africa of today, right? And we have to, you know, part of that is a messaging problem. And part of it's an economic, you know, a story that is starting to be told, and sometimes it's told with too rosy of a pair of glasses on. But it is encouraging. So I can tell you from growing up there in Kenya in the back in the 80s and 90s, and what I see today, one of the most encouraging things I've seen is that the greater and the more business you have, the more wealth you have, and the more wealth you have and disposable income. You decrease risks, right? Sometimes political, sometimes economic, and it's really an encouraging place to be. That the you know seeing the trend getting better over time.
So I'm going to, Eric, stay with you for a minute if I can, because there's an interesting, I think, cross section between good governance and business. That it's very hard to build a strong economy without good governance, and there is certainly a fear of, can I invest in ABC countries if we don't have good governance. In your opinion, out of the 55 countries, what are some of the geographic areas where you feel like there is the stability and good governance to where we could really look to invest in business?
Well, you know, I think there's the kind of obvious countries that can, in each sub-region of Africa, you have countries that tend to do better, and it's relative, right? Like, Kenya is great because, you know, Ethiopia, Sudan, Somalia, Tanzania, and Uganda are so poor, right? Not because it's so amazing. It's just amazing compared to what's around it most of the time, right? But Kenya's good. You know, there's some governance issues, but that has gotten better. I'd say that one of, you know, then you've got Ghana, I think, is a really strong one. Cameroon, Senegal has proven pretty strong. You've also got of course, South Africa, which has actually, you know, had some negative trends lately, it's still a great place. It has all the infrastructure and all the capital. So that's a beautiful place to work still. Egypt was doing so well. And I don't know if you'd say it's good governance or bad governance or just no governance. but, you know, there still is a great deal of business to be done there. And here's maybe the more interesting thing is that in Africa, more than you would find here in the States, you know, the business class and the political class are the same. And when you have that problem, then it can lead you in very bad ways, but it can also lead you in some interesting ways. One of those is, I'll take you back to the post-election violence in Kenya in 2008, okay? That's where Ushahidi got started during that very first week of that, you know, that post-election violence. So we were, of course, you know, very close to it. And one of the things that, you know, I don't know if it's just rumor and hearsay, right? But one of the interesting things that came out of it was that there was pressure from the business class to say, okay, politicians, you've had your time of this, but we need to get back to making money. And the biggest IPO that Kenya had ever seen, the Safaricom IPO, was about to go live in, I think, March or April that year. And before that IPO went live, the violence ceased. So business, I think, has it provides the opportunity to do things and change things in Africa more than any aid or development work can.
Mariam, let me ask you. I'm so excited about the actual technology innovations that are happening. I know you really focus in also on the cross section of women in technology, but I'm just curious because you've invested in so many. What would surprise us in this room that you're seeing from a technology front? And I'll give an example: is Dell Computer and I went to Kenya last week or week before last, and to learn from the e-waste recycling programs that are happening there to bring them back here. So are there technology that's being leapfrogged and that is really going to surprise us?
What I've been doing lately is to talk about frugal innovation in Africa. And I've been doing the inventory of all the frugal innovation we have in the continent. And I was surprised in Uganda that they have many, many frugal innovations that didn't get investment. So the United Nations, the World Bank have invested in this before, but now they are trying to revitalize them. Mm-hmm. That was really surprising for me. And I'm working with Barbara Burungi in Kampala. She's currently developing an app on family planning, on family planning issues. And we don't have that. In the UK, we don't have family planning apps. But can you imagine that young lady developing an app on family planning, and all you need to do is sell that to Melinda Gates and Bill Gates, and they will buy that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't have any, especially in the universities, in what I see with women across the world is that the universities in the West, the women, the young women from 16 to 25, they don't think about innovation. They don't think they think innovation is like, you know, social media, Twitter, Facebook, and that's it. But when you go to Senegal in my country, or you go to Uganda, or you go to Kenya in Nairobi, you see girls developing, they're coding with no internet connection or no laptops, and they're coding in a heat. In a massive pressure, and they're reading books from Java to PHP, and I think that's what is surprising, because I didn't have education. I didn't have education from 5 years old to 16 years old. I didn't have a formal education, so I started having education when I was in the West at 16 years old. So if you see now young Africans, young women developing, you know, coding, you said, wow. So I think the West, we need to understand that, and I think that for me, that is what is impressive.
Okay. And Jake, I'm going to ask you probably the hardest question here. So we've just heard of great things happening on this continent. And as a person who's really big into narrative and telling the story, what do you think public perception is? A continent of opportunity or problems? And or can we go in the middle and reframe it as maybe it's opportunity or something along those lines? But
well,
love
you know,
to hear.
You know what? Eric and I were talking about this before the panel. As somebody who's starting to cover this new narrative, it's been challenging because on one hand, you want to report, and one of my great lines that I got from Carol Pinot, who's a journalist who does Africa, is you just want to report the news, where you don't want to be, are you too positive or are you too negative? So what I've tried to do is do that. The news, if you strip it from editorial, there's a lot of positive news. And I mean, the balance for me has not been, this has been not to be seen as some PR agent for the continent, but also, you know, to be realistic about, there are still massive challenges. And, you know, I have friends that read some things I've written and then they go to Lagos and they're like, hey man, what were you talking about? You know, I'm stuck in traffic here and, you know, I barely got through customs. So I'm liking the fact that finally, and what I think is happening is as Africa, the business narrative normalizes, and as it becomes less of an if question to Africa's a viable investment destination, just like anywhere else, you start to cover it like you would anywhere else, where anywhere else, even the United States or other places, they have things happening that are positive. And they have things that are challenges. And that's the challenge. But where I see news going, starting to, and where it should, is starting to cover things like you would anywhere else, which is really trying to draft a narrative around both the good and the bad. And unfortunately, it really is true. Even though a lot of the negative things that are reported on Africa, a lot of them are true, they've been focused on two predominantly. And the way news has been covered from Africa, if you look at the structure, where people are, how they're dispatched, there has been a definite, even giving some credit to the fact that some of these things are true, and Africa does have definite challenges and some very negative trends, it's been lopsided toward just the negative part. And that's, you know, what I've tried to do is get to a point where we report the news. Mm-hmm. And the news is some good, some bad, mm-hmm. And you try to put it together and put some analysis and conclusions around it.
So Jake, you said something to me earlier about, like, you were, for the first time, you had a story come back to you from the editor. Can you explain that story a little bit?
Well, I've written for a lot of outlets, and at the same time, the news has to be entertaining, and I've been pushed, I'm not going to name names so I don't get in trouble here, but many times I've been pushed in the direction of this Africa Rising narrative, and normally what I've done is I've told it and I've put in some caveats. I did a piece recently for the Atlantic Courts that was, I think, the intersection of this challenge of what the good parts of Africa and the old Africa. And a very quick summary is that the central bank minister, or central bank governor of Nigeria, kind of a poster boy for the new Nigeria named Lamido Sanusi, who's spoken at TEDx, and, you know, he's a very competent central bank minister, went and exposed what he alleges is $20 billion of oil theft from the Nigerian state oil ministry. He went on a trip, he came home, and he was fired with a phony letter to the president. This story captures a couple things. One, it captures that, on one hand, Nigeria is a viable investment market. There's a lot of very real stuff going on there that make it a viable investment market and is worth writing about. But at the same time, as Nigeria tries to go in that direction, it doesn't mean that this old cronyism hasn't gone away. It's now being exposed more, and there's now more of a hypocrisy around it than there was before. But what Eric was alluding to is courts very much, and thankfully so, encourage me to report it, not in this Africa Rising narrative, well, it's not so much fits into that, but just report it as a regular news story, and not as an expat trying to describe something going on back to Americans mm-hmm. as, you know, you're reporting this as a hard news story. And that's the direction where I mm-hmm. think things need to go, and, you know, hopefully they are.
Eric, I think something interesting is, with iHub, you've created a model of bringing individuals together. And how many did you say are in the same building?
Yeah, we have 11,000 members.
So I think another interest that this group in the room might have is maybe we're not comfortable going all the way in or have the knowledge to invest in companies themselves, but are there models that can support the growth of other companies or promoting entrepreneurism, mentorship, not much different than the trends around here from Startup Grind to Startup Weekend and everything that's happening, frankly, in the U.S. But could you talk a bit about iHub and then other models that you've seen that are working well?
Yeah. So iHub, you know, I remember when people first started talking about it as a model and we were like, well, we're just experimenting still. We don't even know what we're doing. But the basic idea was this, that if you create a space, an actual physical space where people can come, you create a nexus point where the people who are in that community can actually interact. So it's not just the kind of tech startup guys, but it's also our corporate partners. You know, we've got Google, Nokia, Intel, Microsoft, IBM are our friends, Samsung and Qualcomm. You know, you name them all, they all come through, as well as the investors, as well as the academics, as well as the government officials, when they want to know and interact with people and talk to certain things. And so you've got this melting pot of ideas and talent. And when you have that kind of space, interesting things happen. And you don't know what they're going to be. That's the one thing. You're basically courting serendipity, though you don't know how it'll work. Mm. So what's happened is that there's been now a kind of an explosion of tech hubs and these kind of spaces across the continent. In I think 30-something countries now, you'll find a tech hub type place. You'll find, you know, two in Senegal, three in Uganda, you know, three in Nigeria. There's, you know, more that have popped. I think we have four more in Kenya now. And it's actually not a case of, you know, one needs to own the space. It means it's that there's a great wealth of individuals with ideas and talent, and we need to create enough to absorb that all. Mm-hmm. Right, mm-hmm. And find avenues for different types of people to do different things, to kind of bring it home with a real story. You know, besides seeing the startups kind of start with a 2-person startup and then grow into a 50-person company, we've seen that. But that's a normal story from anywhere. I remember when the permanent secretary for information and communications came into the iHub and said, "Hey, you guys want? I keep hearing you guys want open data. What do you mean by that?" Right. And there, the next 2 hours was this kind of just condensed room with, 150 people in there, going back and forth and debating with the highest member in the bureaucracy, mm-hmm. About what can be done. He was saying, "Well, if you need that data, I'll walk you into that office myself." And what happened was a couple months later, the World Bank partnered with the permanent secretary and they opened up Sub-Saharan Africa's first open data portal. Hmm. Right. So interesting things happen when you bring in enough smart people into a room.
So I want to get to the questions, but one thing I'll just add on that is that as a representative of the UN, nine agencies from UNICEF to World Food Program are actually signing off on a joint set of innovation principles, and open source was the biggest debate. So I think it's just really interesting. We're going to start our questions from the audience here. And Jake, I think this is an interesting question for you. It says there's impressive progress, but how do you feel about the increasing income disparity between those who have reached success and those throughout Africa who are still less than a dollar a day?
Well, it's becoming a rising topic, but it's the question of would you rather have less capital coming into the continent to distribute than more? The question of how these economic gains are distributed in dividends to Africa's rank and file, it's a growing question, and it's one that I think each country has to work out. But I do know, and I've listened to a lot of African policymakers and entrepreneurs, and the other thing to note is that more and more in the question of socioeconomic data around Africa, more and more, and this is definitely going to continue, Africans are starting to drive their own development agenda. From a philanthropic level, you have names now like Dangote and Tony Ilamelu and Mo Ibrahim, who rather than NGOs and foreign aid agencies are starting to say it's time to take responsibility for this ourselves. So anytime you have this huge booming economic movement like you're having in Africa, you're going to have questions of income disparity. You're going to have questions of transparency. But we need to remember those questions happen here. In many ways, with breaking up trusts. My view, because what happens is a lot of people will put forward that view who may have views that are more leaning, that they're maybe distrustful of business and global economic powers. And the question is, well, would you rather not have, was Africa better off without all this investment going in? It may not be getting distributed right. It may be happening in some ways, in ways that are less than scrupulous. But would the continent, in terms of a world where a lot of things, value is determined and how you spread value around to improve living standards, my point is it's imperfect, but you're better off to have capital amassing around you. Mm-hmm. At least it gives you an opportunity to start doing stuff rather than to not have capital at all. And that's where Africa has been, and we've seen where that has gone.
Eric and Mariam, you're both nodding your heads. Both want to add to this?
I think the middle class of Africans, if you go to Africa now, people have money in Africa. I live in the UK. There's a poverty in the West. There's absolute poverty. Even in San Francisco, I've seen homeless people here. So the thing is our mindset, the way we see African people, the way we see how African people can consume. You go to Lagos today, women have got 3 mobile phones. People are consuming and they're buying. Got massive brands going across Africa and selling their products. So I think my point is we need to really start seeing the African continent as people who actually can consume and can buy things, because now, you have people working for Google, for big organizations. They got a salary of $1,500 per month. They can consume. You know, we got so many malls across Africa. So, but, you know, if you are in the United States or in London, you know, where we talk about $1 a day, you say, well, African people can buy that. But that's just a prejudice, which is not true. So we need to see Africans as equal, in my view.
Commenter?
I agree with both of them.
Perfect. Ditto is a good answer. So we have two questions about China here. So I'm going to read them both. And I'll just say that over the last month when I was looking at entrepreneurism, I had visceral questions and reactions in four countries about the role of the Chinese government. So I look forward to your answers to this as well. So one says, what role does China play in encouraging entrepreneurship and development through their foreign direct investment? And the second one says, to what extent will China succeed in its attempts to penetrate Africa economically? So I'll let you all take a stab. Absolutely.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
All right. So China is really interesting. I mean, is it FDI or is it contracts that go and stay within the money that stays in China? Right? That's, you know, take a closer look at the deals, right? Mm-hmm. However, they are deals. And this is one of the great things about what China is doing. So it's not all positive. It's not all negative. One of the things that they're doing is that they're actually treating African countries. And remember, we're talking about 55 countries here, right? We talk about it as a big bucket a lot of times. But, you know, each country is making their own decisions on this. And they're going in there and they're taking a look at it. And they're not being treated condescendingly by some aid or development group. They're being treated like a business deal. And sure, there might be some payoffs along the way, and that's what, you know, greases the wheels. But at least roads are being built, right? At least things are happening. And they have, you know, something counter to that kind of, you know, condescension that they've had for decades from the West. You know, so they have something to balance off of it again. They haven't had that since the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. I don't mind China going to Africa, and I think that the African government need education on the contract they signed with China. That's something definitely they need to look up to. But when I was going to Dakar 7 years ago, it used to take me 3 hours from Dakar to my village in Kaolack. Now it takes me 1 hour. When I go to Maputo in Mozambique, you know, I see buildings, I see stuff being built by Chinese people. You know, it may be bad, the United States may see, you know, China as invading Africa, but for us, you know, as for as infrastructure or something which is really pragmatic, we don't mind China building roads for us or, you know, making things easy for us in Africa. And I think the United States need to get used to that, but because China is there to stay, they're not going to go away.
Any thoughts,
Shane? I agree with what's been said, and what I would add is, as imperfect as it is, the Chinese are bringing something to the table. I had the good fortune of working with Rosa Whitaker, who, you know, was the champion of the Africa Trade Bill, and she always jokes that when she interacts with African governments, their joke about the United States is that with the U.S. you get more lecture for less. So, you know, the Chinese are bringing something to the table. I would caution to look less at China and realize that a mass of countries are now investing huge amounts, I mean, in Africa, Turkey, Brazil, Russia, mm-hmm. and the issues around it, there have been transparency issues, there are some questions about land grabs, but I think this goes back to this question of, as Africa evolves economically, there needs to be the accompanying public sector reform so that, you know, people are, you know, both at a public level and a government level are really looking with a fine-tooth comb over these deals and having some say in it. And the other one thing I'll say is that I think there's also a role for you know, an increased African media presence. Mm-hmm. Newspapers and journalism have just gotten, sorry, the crap kicked out of them for a long time in Africa. And I think a lot of naming and shaming that may need to happen on the side of some of these bad deals that are going on, as African media starts to find more of its role and its footing, that there'll be more of a check and balance against some of these bad examples of sovereign investment that you see going into the continent.
Jake, do you see a follow-up question? Country-owned multimedia companies, excuse me, locals in that country, so, you know, a Ugandan who's building a strong multimedia company. I mean, do you see those growing as they have here and overall in the West?
I see a lot more, and it may be just proximity. There's a lot of media companies growing in the United States around Africa who are entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. Diaspora entrepreneurs who have started to grow things here. Most of them, and Eric and Marion may have some examples more of their home countries, but in my example, especially, or my knowledge, especially in Nigeria, a lot of the newspapers are still
very much plugged into the political and the business elite. Mm-hmm. One real quick case study that I would say is, I don't know if anybody's heard of Sahar Reporters, mm-hmm. but Omiyala Sowore is a guy that was an activist and a journalist in Nigeria that was trying to name and shame corruption, and he got tired of getting thrown in jail, and he's been beaten up a ton of times. He left Nigeria. He formed Sahar Reporters from a basement in New York, got Ford Foundation funding. And the model that he's followed is doing like investigative journalism from the umbrella of the protection of the U.S. and outing things back in Nigeria. So I've seen more of that, and I guess I defer to anything that...
Let me ask one more question before you respond. I'm sorry. This is too interesting not to. Print versus mobile versus online consumption of news on the continent.
Well, I'm going to go in and out of this because I think Mariam and Eric can definitely pipe in. I've heard people joke about Twitter as a news source. When it comes to Africa and African tech and business news, Twitter in some ways, and when it comes to investigative reporting, like even Sowore will tell me that a lot of the stuff that we have to verify and they have to do their Woodward and Bernstein stuff on it afterwards, they're like, that stuff was out there. They're like, it was on Twitter. We just couldn't report it in Nigeria because we'd get thrown in jail or they'd come and beat the crap out of us. So for investigative reporting, mobile is very important. And when it comes to business news, like we did a story to coordinate with this panel with this girl, Africa Techie, Rebecca Enenchong, who is a tech CEO. We did it for the FT, a tech CEO who just started tweeting stuff. She's now become the unofficial source of tech business news on the net. She has 30,000 followers. And it's almost a requisite that if you want to follow African tech, if you wanted me to tell you a newspaper to follow, I may have some suggestions, but I probably would say, go follow Africa Techie on Twitter.
Mariam, thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, there's a competition now between the Western media and the African bloggers and Twitter really prominent Twitter experts, for example, I will say. And the reason why I guess the West is now very focused in writing for Africa, in trying to get involved into the African content. Like if you just take Eric Hirschman, kind of like he's very humble. He doesn't talk about many things what he does, but he's one of the first guys that wrote White African, a blog about tech in Africa. Now the Africa techie you're talking about, that lady Rebecca, she was writing about tech in Africa, but she couldn't come forward because she was, you know, very scared and very worried about what people will say from her country. But when people like Eric used to write about tech in Africa, this is a long time ago. We're talking about like 7 years ago. They used to write about this. And then after that, you see the media start, CNN, you get The Guardian, BBC, everybody starting to come and write about tech in Africa. Some of the content is not really good content. Tell me, I can tell you that. But some of the content is... Now the African people, the bloggers, the African people on the ground and in Africa and outside Africa are writing about what's really happening in the continent. You got people like Paul Kagame who's got, you know, a hashtag just for his own name. And yesterday, for example, he was tweeting about, you know, science, technology, innovation in Africa from his own country in Kigali. I think the problem we have, right, there's a competition between the Western journalists and the African journalists. And you will find out that, you know, when I blog about something, it comes up because it's the African who's writing it. And I think sometimes we need to share ideas, we need to work together. The Western journalists need to work with the African journalists to get the content correct. Because sometimes I see... You know, Western journalists writing something is very European focused. It's not fact and evidence based. And I think sometimes, you know, we all need to have this individual consciousness when we write about Africa, because we, the West, we the one who wrote about Africa for 80 years, BBC, for example. And sometimes it's the wrong narratives. I know the demography is different. I know sometimes when you're writing for, you know, Western audience is different. But right now, the Africans are blowing their own trumpets and they're writing for their own, you know, for their own narratives that comes fresh from the continent. Nairobi, you have amazing people writing. Zimbabwe, everywhere. But I think my advice is for, you know, Africans now have got access to devices. They can read and they can now say, this is not true, this is wrong. You know, when you write something about Africa, they can go on Twitter and Facebook and say, who are you? Why are you writing about Africa like this? They do this all the time with CNN. I think what I really would like to say is that the Western journalists or the people that want to write about Africa, they need to start talking to the African people on the ground or expert about Africa. Then the narratives is actually equal and just and fair. Otherwise, it just is wrong. And we're going to be perpetrating the same old narratives about Africa, which is wrong.
Eric, let me, since you brought up South Africa in your opening, Let me just ask you this question from the audience. It says, how will the passing of Nelson Mandela and the diminishing stature of the ANC impact South Africa's economic prospects?
Wow.
Easy. Okay. That's a really easy question.
Yeah, and not being a South African, I'm not going to have the kind of nuanced understanding of that. I'd say Mandela passing is obviously a big deal on many levels, because he represented so much to so many, not just even in South Africa, but across the continent. And I think what the ANC has been doing and the kind of increased cronyism that we've been seeing in South Africa has nothing but a negative impact on their business and their economic levels in the country. It's not a good thing. Can I weigh in on this media thing?
Please,
though?
Go. Okay. I know, it's a hot topic.
All right. So I think the media thing is actually multifaceted, right? There's the media, like how do Africans consume media was part of the question. Yeah. Well, it's radio and newspaper still, right? That is it, right? And then if you're talking about how do Westerners receive media about Africa, well, then it's a mixture of mediums and channels too now, right? It's not going to be necessarily the nation media in Kenya who talks to the people who live overseas, except the diaspora. They read it religiously, right? So the way that Twitter and some of these other new media forms can unearth information has already been proven true, not just in Africa, but all over the world, right? So it's a channel that can be used for multiple forms of both journalism and for transparency. Right, it is an interesting time to be in politics when you it's a little bit harder to hide, and the biggest difference is now it's just showing that actually the government some of the politicians just don't care when they're caught either. Nothing happens to them. Yeah.
I hope there's a panel somewhere in this building on media on the continent of Africa. Miriam, this is specifically to you. What is being done, and what more can be done to ensure that women have equal access to venture capital? And I think saying that our friends down the street in Palo Alto, there's only 3% women leadership in that space. So yeah, we have a lot to go here. But what's going on in your view?
It's very hard for women across Africa right now. What I've realized recently is that we have amazing women. We have around 48 women network right now across Africa. Well, started in Nairobi at the IHUB. So we have a really amazing, the iHub Nairobi is really the benchmark, I will say, in my view, that for all the tech hubs we have across Africa, all the open spaces where people can go and create and innovate. But the African women, they are developing apps. So they can develop apps, e-commerce sites, they understand the technology. They can do that. But when it comes to investing in women, what I'm trying to do right now is to change the mentality, the mindset from seeing the African woman as the object of development. This is very hard for me to do, but this is what happening right now in the continent. Now, for people to understand that actually African women can become CEOs and millionaires and they can run their own companies, just like in the United Kingdom, that's very difficult for people to comprehend and understand. It's going to take time. So, but if you go to Rwanda, for example, which I've seen a couple of weeks ago, you know, you go to the woman, the House of Parliament, for example, you got 64% of the women being in the parliament, which is when I come to the UK, I can give the example of the UK government. So they can start changing their minds a little bit about women in politics, women in classrooms, and women running businesses. So for people to invest into the African woman in Africa, for example, my girls in the girls I'm supporting in Senegal, they've got difficulty getting funding. Because what you see the charity organizations and the United Nations, sorry about to mention that, but the World Bank, you know, they only see those girls as kind of like an example of when they're writing an article, they will see Binta, a woman tech in Senegal, then they can blog about that. They don't see Binta can organize, can develop an app, she can have a business around that app, and she can become a profitable businesswoman, business techie in Senegal. So that's very difficult for me to right now to kind of like sell people. So that's the biggest issue women have right now. In the UK, we have women techies, and you know, they have access to venture capitalists and investors, but in Senegal, in Africa, in general, women are having difficulties getting funding. So they do get funding, small grants. They go to the, you know, they participate to competitions. But somebody saying, I can invest $100,000 into your app, like Barbara, for example, we need the app to finish for that to be given to Melinda Gates, for her to say, okay, I'm happy to invest in this, but it will be a kind of like a philanthropic investment, for example. So it's very hard for women to get investment. I'm hoping that maybe we can open a women venture capitalist, you know, kind of like network soon to invest in those women. But I've seen that in the Middle East. But in Africa, people don't see yet, they haven't seen yet the African woman as a business person. They only see the African woman as the object of development, which is very, very sad.
Elizabeth, can I just chime in quickly on that? Just to reinforce some of what Mariam said, is the story we did in the FT, I asked this Africa techie, Rebecca Ananchong, about this question. And what she started to outline was this dichotomy of African tech, but that's starting to emerge, but also this problem of people trying, especially with her as a woman techie, to put it in one category. And the dichotomy is that, you know, African tech got a lot of news for creating applications that had kind of social venture focuses, where now you have some techies and startups, like Rebecca will say, I'm a woman, I'm not doing this for a social venture. I have a full-on for-profit, you know, I want to make money and be like somebody in Silicon Valley tech entrepreneur. And she told me that she generally gets ready for a 5 to 10 minute conversation every time someone seeks her out to try to roll back this impression that somehow she's doing this to create apps to deal with maternal health or something like that. You have the two sides of it developing now.
Even though we're okay with that, too.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask all of you to comment on this question. It's something I'm very passionate about, and I'd love folks on the radio to tweet at us your thoughts on this question. What role are the global youth playing in Africa on the globalization of Africa? Just giving context, so we're in the largest youth generation of our history. And so at EMGoreUN is what you can tweet at. But I'd love to hear about the role of youth in each of the areas that you're talking about. And Eric, would you mind starting?
Well, yeah, I'd say that we're mostly youth, right? That's the large majority of the tech entrepreneurship that's happening in East Africa anyway is driven by people who are at least under 35, if not under 30. And that doesn't mean they're always successful, right? It's just like everywhere else. You know, you've got a lot of guys trying things. They're not very experienced, and they fail at it, and then they try something else. The youth is pivotal for this. And I think why I think technology is important is it's because it's opened up new spaces with lower barriers to entry and less gatekeepers. So when you're somebody who's young and trying to do something, you see that there's opportunity here because now over the past couple of years we've shown success stories, and there's jobs because Google and IBM and Intel are there. But you know, you also see that there's not a lot of gatekeepers to stop you from going that way. And if you create your own business, there's no borders where we live in the web world and the internet. So you can start selling your products globally immediately, and that becomes really interesting. Mm.
Okay. There is a big problem with the African youth right now. What I've seen in my anyway, 3 years ago we did something with the State Department called Apps for Africa, and I met so many young people across the continent. It's not because they don't have the ideas; they do have the ideas. They have they can develop apps, they can create businesses, but they don't have the right ecosystems in their own countries. For example, that's number one. Number two, when they create their companies across Africa. They don't have investors. They don't have funding, for example, to do it. And those organizations, they don't make profit at all. You know, probably $2,000, $3,000 per month. That's what they don't even make that. So I think the what we're trying to do right now is to mentor them. Mentorship is a big issue across the continent. And we're trying to really address this. So there's an amazing guy called Ashir. So he's doing the Mara group in Uganda. So they're really trying to mentor people. And we just started the Cheetah Generation in the UK. We're trying to mentor the young Africans. When I say mentor, they need somebody to sit down with them, just show them the basic things. That's what the African youth, that's what they need. So it's not because the ideas are not there, or they can't innovate, or they can't create things, but you know they need to go to the IHOP, for example, have somebody to sit down with them one-to-one. Tell me about your business. What are you doing? How can you improve that? We don't have that. So mentorship is a big issue right now in the continent. So if you guys have the spare time that you can share with those people just to mentor them, to help them, that probably will improve the youth issues we have around businesses across Africa. And also investing in them, trusting them, you know, because they all get grants. competition money, $10,000, $5,000. It's not enough. That money that money just serves as operational costs, internet and paying the buildings. But somebody having a time with them, and I've seen that happening. And when I see that, when you give them time, a little bit of time, 1 hour on Skype, just sit down with them and say, tell me about what you're doing. Tell me about your innovation. And kind of like force them, challenge them. And you can see, you know, I met this guy in China, Oscar, his name is. He developed an app on food waste. And we all know, living in the West, how food waste is a big issue, especially in the UK. We waste so much food. And he's just developed an app. But that guy has got an idea and a prototype. But he doesn't have anybody to sit down with him and tell him, let's go through your, you know, life cycle, the business. Tell me how you're going to improve it. Tell me how you're going to make money out of this. That's all he needs. He needs just somebody to believe in him and sit down and help him go through the prototype and develop it as a product. In the end, he become profitable. So mentorship is a big issue right now for the youth in Africa. I think we need to focus on mentoring them, investing into mentorship programs, you know, either you know, into tech hubs in Africa or having a one-to-one, you know, with the guys and just support them.
Jake, thoughts on youth?
Yeah, just quickly, I would say that Africa's youth are absolutely pivotal to every single part of the continent's future. Both now and moving forward, young people are going to make up a huge part of the continent. And I would break it down into two categories. I would say the youth, in one sense, represent a lot of capacity. But in another, and I'm working on a chapter on this in a book I'm writing about how Africa's youth are also going to be a tremendous challenge. On the challenge side, African youth predominantly, if you talk to African youth, they want jobs. And we get back to this question of these economic headlines, and if they don't start paying dividends to Africa's rank and file, including the youth, this is where I think you could start seeing real political movements and a source of pressure moving forward to politicians. That if they don't deliver on getting opportunities and jobs to this growing youth population, many of whom are just, you know, they want jobs and education, that's going to factor very, very dominantly in Africa's political narrative. On the capacity side, and some of this has overlap with the continent, I would say that the youth present a huge amount of capacity, and I would say more my experiences with the diaspora. There's a huge group of what I call white-collar dropouts and diaspora entrepreneurs. These are people whose parents they moved out of Africa, didn't have access to education. So when their parents got to places like the UK or the US, they just beat the drum of education, education, education. These are first-generation African immigrants who have gone to the best schools. They've been in Goldman Sachs. They've been in McKinsey. And more, these people are dropping out to go back to Africa and start businesses. I mean, I know at least 20 people just I know socially in New York. I mean, you have people like Chinedu Achero, who started Hopstop.com, who's now moved back. These youth that are moving back to Africa, who've built all this capacity in the U.S., I think they're going to be a tremendous influence both in sharing that capacity and giving some of the mentorship you talk about. And the other thing is they're connected to capital. They're bringing money. There's a lot of family money that's being pooled from Nigerians in Texas and here to fund startups. They're tapping into more conventional sources of funding. There's even a Silicon Valley startup that I've done stuff with right here called Echo VC, formed by a Nigerian guy, Ekosa Mwigwi, who dropped out of Intel and is funneling investments back to Africa. So in terms of the diaspora youth that are part of this white-collar dropout diaspora entrepreneur movement, I think they're going to play a pivotal role in bringing capacity and capital back to the continent.
But I just want to add, we need like the Savannah Fund, like Eric was talking about. There's still a deficit of trust in Africa, as you all know. There'll be a problem of investing into those entrepreneurs I'm talking about. When I talk to them, that's the problem they have. But if you have the Savannah Fund, let's say you want to invest $10,000, we need a pot of money where we can invest. We can put the money in and invest into those entrepreneurs. So the Savannah Fund and all the kind of like credible funds across Africa, you can put your money there to invest in them. The entrepreneurs, right now, what is really killing the entrepreneurs and the youth across Africa is this amount of competition we organize across Africa. Because what they do, they give them the $10,000 and then there's no mentorship behind it, there's nothing behind it, absolutely nothing. And I've seen this failing the amount of the youth in Africa, you have no idea, really. So I think my suggestion will be to put the money into funds like the Savannah Fund or other credible fund. Then you can see at least the project and the entrepreneurs growing, and you can see the return on investment. That will be my suggestion. But you know, that we have a massive issue right now. I don't want to tell you everything is fine in that side, but investment, the reason why people don't invest, especially the diaspora as myself, that is why I don't invest in some of the entrepreneurs, because I don't know where my money will go. That's number one. And I'm not going to invest into a prototype or just a concept of ideas. I want to invest into a product. But if you put your money into funds like that, then you can see the return investment, because you've got trusted people who actually you can trust, and also you can see the project moving forward.
So as we close the radio portion of this, I'm going to ask you three for Twitter size answer. So that's a sentence. On this final question, which I think is a great way to do a final statement, in one sentence or less, how can we encourage the international community to invest in Africa? Eric.
Oh, God. All right. I'd say to encourage the West to invest in Africa, put on a new pair of glasses.
Well done.
I think I'm going to join Eric. It's never too late to change our prejudices, and we don't want to die ignorant. But Africa is progressing, and if you don't invest in Africa right now, it's going to be at your peril, because the continent will grow.
I would say it's hard to encourage investors. Create the environment and the returns, and they'll come. They're not going to need encouragement. And I use my 40 characters up there.
Well done. So I'm going to turn now to finish some of our questions from the audience. And one that was in here I thought was really interesting. They're all interesting. But can you name a few specific countries that are rising above the rest, specifically in intellectual capital and more investment capital?
Yeah, so I mentioned them earlier too, but you've got Ghana, Nigeria, Kenya, Cameroon, South Africa, Egypt, Senegal, as kind of leaders in that space, and they're not all equal, but yeah, those are the ones that I would say that kind of low hanging fruit.
I'll say Mozambique. I'm very close to the government of Mozambique. So Mozambique is a very good place right now to invest, because the government have got very clear ICT policies, so you can invest in there. Senegal, my country, we are very, very focused on good governance and transparency, and the president is very prominent. Rwanda also, Kagame has got a very good vision on STEM subjects, which are really crucial for education. So those countries, I will say, if you want to invest in. And Uganda is also good. So, but those specific countries are doing amazingly well right now, and that's where we're gonna focus our investment this year.
I agree with those countries. I'll put a little bit of a different twist on it. I've been trying to come up with a metric to determine which countries are going to be the most profitable and leap forward. And the countries that I've been looking at, I've come up with this HDGD thing about countries that have high growth. Are issuing global bonds. This is a new twist in terms of looking in things that weren't happening in Africa and are now, and I've written on this. Last year, African governments issued roughly $10 billion of sovereign bonds, the equivalent of what a U.S. Treasury is. And these are countries, Senegal, Nigeria, Kenya, Angola, Ghana. These are countries that previously in global capital markets, which are not glamorous, but they're tremendously influential in terms of how businesses and innovation get funding. These were pariah nations in terms of global capital markets, only years ago. And to do this, they're having to get sovereign bond ratings by the rating agencies, which means they're having to align all these macroeconomic fundamentals. And you have places like Nigeria that are issuing sovereign bonds that are now being listed on J.P. Morgan's benchmark index next to bonds from Brazil and bonds from Russia. And I did a story on this. They're now ending up in investment funds, PIMCO, Franklin Templeton. So what I would say is to me, and the other thing is doing that and connecting these countries more to the global economy, when we get into governance, when we get into questions about South Africa, about repercussions for bad political behavior. When you start to connect like that and you're selling $1 billion of global bonds to investors like PIMCO, and I'm sorry, if you do something wrong, PIMCO doesn't care. They're going to dump your bonds. Your yields are going to spike. It's going to cost you more money to raise money. Your currency is going to tank. The countries that I see that are aligning with these global capital markets and issuing government bonds, to me, those are the countries that I'm really curious to watch.
So this says, please describe the constraints from the lack of wireless availability in some regions in ways you've seen this overcome to still build business.
We have the fiber optic. I don't know if you're aware that we have a fiber optic coming across Africa right now. I was just saying the other day that give Africa another 5 years when the fiber optic has reached all the countries. I mean, even Djibouti, which is a very kind of like very poor country, the fiber optic is passing by there right now and going all the way to Madagascar. So just give Africa another 5 years to see. Everybody will have, most of the people will have access to, to broadband. Broadband is a big issue, and I know the ITU is working on this very closely. Cybersecurity will be a big issue in Africa, but, that will be definitely a big issue in the next 5-10 years. Until actually now, it's going to be a big issue. But let's give Africa the next 5 years when everybody's connected. I see women, really have access to mobile phone. Like I said, 5-10 years ago when I used to see women across villages, they didn't have those kind of thing. But now they have access to mobile phone. They can send money, via M-Pesa. They can send money to their people. I send money to my mom, and I send money to my people across Africa. It's quite easy. I can talk to them. I can show them my house, Skype. It's kind of like difficult, but you can, let's give Africa 5 years. I think what I'm trying to say is that broadband will... people will have broadband access to Africa. They will have more mobile phone getting across Africa. People are working on the continent right now. Right now, people are so busy in the continent. We are so busy. 10 years ago, when I started my company, people didn't care about Africa. They really didn't care about it. I can talk about Africa until tomorrow. People didn't care. But now, we're so busy, and people are busy building the continent. So let's just give Africa a chance, and you'll see the difference.
One of the interesting things about internet in Africa is that, we have the undersea cables coming in all around the continent now. But the terrestrial cable that's being mm-hmm. dug is still expensive and hard, and it takes a while, which is what Mariam is talking to. At the same time, however, we have this island model, right? The island model is basically this. You drop a cell phone tower in, you turn it on, you have 3G, right? So it's expensive, but at least you're connected. And there's really some really interesting business models that have been coming up from the mobile operators to, get people on. You get 8 megabytes for 8 shillings, which is like 5-6 cents, right, per day. That kind of a thing. So it's doable, right? What I'm busy with right now is a company called BRICK, so BRCK. And what we do is we're actually trying to solve this problem too, but it's around this, is that even when you get that island model in there, actually the biggest problem isn't just internet connectivity, it's also power, right? So how do you keep these things on in a low infrastructure environment or where the power goes off and on all the time? It's basically a router, a modem, and battery pack all in one that runs for a full day without going off, and so you can go between network settings or power settings pretty easily. And I think we're going to start seeing more of these kind of products and services that are made for this part of the world.
He's very famous. He's very humble. This is an invention from Africa. This is what he's talking about right now. It's invented by Africans. And Eric is one of the... he's very humble. He doesn't talk about those kind of things.
I think she should be your publicist.
Come on. I've decided. It's true. It's invented in Africa. That's amazing. That will change Africa. That will absolutely change.
Did you pay her before this panel?
Talk about it. He doesn't talk about it. He's just so humble.
Thank you, Mariam.
Let me turn, while we have a few more minutes, to folks that didn't get your question read. And if you could just raise your hand, and we have a microphone coming forward. For anyone who didn't get to get their question answered. If not, I'll go back to the cards the last 8 minutes. Yes, sir, right here. He's just going to hand you the mic real quick.
When I was in Tanzania 6 years ago, it really appeared women physically were doing all the heavy lifting. Men were sitting on the sidelines. And the women were clearly second-class citizens when it came to education. It didn't sit well with me. Is that still true today, or are women being given better opportunity and are men coming to the table in terms of getting off their butt?
Well, women, I can tell you that as an African woman, I don't wait for permissions now. And but African women are really, they have progressed since then. You know, we have a... You know, we have progressed since then, and African women are now taking things in charge. They, you know, they are the economic agents in Africa. And I think that's, you know, there are some villages, people have good cultures, and where, you know, men are still dominant and, you know, telling them what to do. But across the continent, you know, now I can say, like I said, people have access to mobile phones, they got access to the world, they got access to Facebook. And, you know, as women wake up, as the world develop, you know, you'll see women taking control. But yes, we have amazing women across Africa.
I'll just add, though, not to be a downer, but similar to what has been said about generalities, out of the countries that have been mentioned who are really progressing economically, those that aren't, there are significant issues on women and girls. And I would say if I was a philanthropist, that's where I would be putting my charitable money, not my investments, but it is on the progression of policies around women and girls in those countries that weren't mentioned.
And I think there's a danger in treating the symptom and not the disease on this. When it comes to women being invested or being VCs or being business entrepreneurs, you got to go back further, back into the secondary school time. And there's groups like Akira Chicks out of Nairobi who are women in tech in Nairobi who give back to the girls by training them on PHP and HTML and things like that. But, you know, there's just not very many of those. If you look across the continent, you'll probably see half a dozen programs like that, you know, for a continent of a billion people. That's not enough. So, yeah, if you're going to put your philanthropic dollars to use and your, you know, policy is always a good place to put it. But another great place is in the few programs or expanding programs that are focused on getting girls started younger. Mm-hmm. And this is coming from a father with three daughters, you know, so I care about this a lot, too.
Now, Eric is very right. And what you do, those girls, they invest in Senegal, for example. We started with three girls. Now we got 200 girls. And they will go and recruit other girls in universities and something like that, you know. And it's quite crucial. Like I said, you know, I didn't have education from 5 to 16 years old. So when you invest, what you see, the World Bank and the United Nations, I always talk about them, because, the program they have is actually failing those young girls. So we need to start investing more into education. You know, there are so many issues around girls and women across Africa, from female genital mutilation, for example, to human rights and early marriages. And so the reason why I opened the tech hub in Senegal is that, you know, my country is a Muslim country. I was born Muslim. And if I didn't have education that time, you'll see that those girls will just get married. So we need to invest into those girls. Binta, for example, now she's not going to get married. She knows what to do. Invest your money in that. And a female genital mutilation is a big issue right now in Africa. And you've got many women across the United States who are suffering because of that. And we're spending a lot of money here in the United States, in the UK, you know, curing those women for depression and illnesses because they and asylum, immigration, because they're coming here because, you know, they're running away from those issues. So invest your money on that.
Next question from the audience. Yes, ma'am, and he'll be... Oh, we have one. Great. If you could stand up, if you don't mind. Thank you so much.
What do you think are some of the most effective ways of the foundations and entrepreneurs discovering avenues for investing their funds and capital in Africa? Because I don't think there's enough information. I mean, you've touched on some of the entities, but I think we need a lot more information that all four of you could really help provide.
Jake, do you want to start with that?
You know, the fortunate thing is, in some ways, with this formalization of African capital markets that I'm talking about, and that also includes not just the bond side, the fixed income side, but African stock markets, it's gotten easier where there are some African investment funds. There's even one in New York City run by a Ugandan guy, Nile Capital, advertises every day on Bloomberg News. It's a U.S. registered, regulated investment fund where you can put in $1,000 and have a diversified portfolio of African assets. There are a lot of channels, but I think that some of these formalized investment funds, and I don't want to just, you know, tout Niall's horn, but there's a number of those, and they're probably, if you have money and you want to invest in Africa, you can probably go through one of those, and it's much more transparent and regulated and above board than probably any opportunity that you had in the past.
Eric, did you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, there's so on the foundation side, it's interesting. I've you know, for the past 6 years, I've been dealing with foundations as well, specifically U.S. ones, and I think there are a couple that are doing some really interesting things. So, you know, Midyar Network has been doing a lot on entrepreneurship and innovation on the continent, and both doing research and, as well as trying to figure out where to put the money to make the biggest dent. Rockefeller is doing the digital jobs, you know, initiative, which is, you know, tens of millions of dollars being put towards cracking digital jobs for youth. So figuring out that youth bubble problem, right? Really interesting stuff. Tony Elumelu Foundation is a Nigerian one. They do great stuff in Nigeria and continuing to spread beyond even their borders. So a Nigerian entrepreneur who's made a ton of money putting it back into play in the continent. And then also there's small groups like our own Savannah Fund, who we have LPs from the Bay Area to New York and Europe. That, you know, it's just a trusted bridge into that space.
So we have time for one last question, and I wanted to give one of our youth in the room, Rhea Singh, the opportunity. I saw her trying to ask something earlier. Rhea is a high school student here in town and is here on behalf of the World Affairs Council. So I'm going to give Rhea the last question.
Well, as a youth in the room, I guess my question would be, what would be your advice to people like us who don't necessarily have money to invest, but rather have support and peers to invest in socially? So what advice would you have for us to help with this problem?
So let's make this our closing. So each of you make this your closing answer, please. Thank you so much. Jake?
I mean, that one's a tough one for me, and I'll be very quick, because part of me recognizes there still are a lot of challenges in Africa on a socioeconomic level, but part of me is starting to resist this notion that Africa needs to be helped all the time by people from outside. I haven't quite reconciled that yet. I'll leave it at that and let the Africans answer, but there's kind of a knee-jerk that there, you know, that there needs to, we need to help Africa. And Africa's really starting to take charge of a lot of its own stuff right now.
So on that note, maybe for Rhea and her students, is it instead to maybe learn and read about what's really going on?
Really quickly, like Eric mentioned, we've mentioned the Tony Elumelu Foundation. One thing to note about Tony's foundation is they don't take outside funds. It's funded, from what I understand, they fund it from Africa. And what Tony started to do is change perceptions in that he is now bringing non-African students to come to the continent to do internships, and Africans, but to do internships in African companies with the idea that they're not coming to help anybody. They're coming to learn from what's going on in Africa. So, and that gets into this challenge I have writing, because you write about the good, and then you still have these glaring examples of socioeconomic problems. This knee-jerk that the first thing we need to do is help Africa, to start a charity. A celebrity now wants to up their PR campaign. Let's help Africa. I'm starting to reject that, and I guess this is editorial. I'm definitely editorial there. But I think the continent is starting to reject that. So I'm going to back out of this one.
No, that's okay. Well, I think you actually gave great advice that maybe Rhea and her friends go actually intern and learn from her peers in Africa.
I mean, I never went. I've been going back and forth to the continent since I was 19. I never went in Peace Corps. I went to learn, and I saw bad stuff, and many times, I've been in war zones in Africa. I didn't let it become my predominant view. I went to learn, and I've learned at every turn, and that's the view I've taken, and I think that's going to be more of this balanced exchange that happens in the future in these partnerships. That Africa is not necessarily a place to go and help people. Maybe you can go and learn stuff there. I mean, look at Eric and Miriam's work. People are going to learn about tech hubs and technology and tech incubation. They're not going to help. They're going to look at these models and how could we replicate these things somewhere else.
I think Jake has summed that up for us. he's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. The thing is, when you are, I'm lucky, I'm in both continents. You know, I'm in Europe and in Africa at the same time. You know, I just bought this book for you to read later. It's called The Relented Innovator. It's been written by amazing people that actually have been to Africa. They failed, they started, wanted to do something in Africa, and right now they had amazing results. And my friend next to me has made a contribution in it, but he's very humble. He wouldn't say it. So, so it's inside. It's amazing. If you really want to learn how people started working in Africa, this is the book you need to read, and it's written by Ken Banks. So Ken is there. Just to close, we need to work together. We all have responsibility when it comes to Africa, really. We all have responsibilities. African people don't need help right now. They don't need help. They don't need people coming dictating them what to do. What they need to do is to share ideas, to share ideas with people. So, for example, you can go and share. If you go to Nairobi today, you can sit with Jessica Koloko. By the time you come back, you'll be amazed, really amazed. I'm just giving her a shout out. We need to start sharing ideas when it comes to Africa. We need to see Africa as a continent where we all together have responsibility to make it a better continent. That's what we need to, that's what I want you guys to take out from this. Let's see Africa as our, Africans as our equal, and let's learn more about the continent and the people that actually are in the continent who are doing amazing work, from the youth to anybody else. But let's share ideas. Sharing ideas is crucial right now for Africa.
Thank you, Eric.
So each year I take an intern, a personal intern over the summer, and they've been 18, 19, and 20 years old, from US, and Singapore. It's interesting, the very first one who came out now is a major player in the Bay Area, and he was choosing between going to Facebook and doing his internship with an executive there, coming out to Kenya, and he thought, well, I'm passing up on meeting a bunch of interesting people and doing stuff. Well, he learned so much more, and he met Marissa Meyer and Vint Cerf and all the other people in the iHub in Nairobi, and you know, it opened up his world to this other stuff that's going on in such a way that he was able to come back, and he runs and has a completely different worldview on his own business now. I think, you know, for people like you, you know, who are youth here, absolutely visit, and, you know, realize you're visiting peers and take what you can from it. And also, I think one of the biggest things is having Africans come, abroad as well and getting a different worldview the other way. That needs to happen also.
Great advice, Eric. Thank you. So I'm going to thank our panelists, Jake, Mariam, and Eric, for joining us today and showing us how innovative our 55 countries are.